Okay, let's get started.
So did you all see what I posted on the wiki last night? A little more like early this morning.
So I have to change a permission, but TLS notes solutions are up already.
That's a little loud.
Okay, so still good, yeah.
So TLS notes solutions are up. That's for assignment 10. I just have to change the permissions on them, then you can download them. But the thing you'll probably want to spend more time looking at is exam notes. Exam notes is the TLS notes solutions cut down, because it takes a lot of pages to draw the source code
for the thing. So I'm trying to have a smaller one that I can print, so there's a fully functional application that has
that I can still fit on the exam without using too many pieces of paper. Out of curiosity, if I were to print the source code to a page as opposed to just one, I shrunk it and put two sides, that would probably cause a little difficulty to go read. Yeah, okay, fine.
Okay. I will do double-sided, but... Oh, look how long it's taking me to log into this computer. Maybe I should run my laptop. But I didn't want to actually spend time going through code. I wanted to talk more concepts and things, so I'm happy to talk about a chalkboard.
I'm going to take some pictures of this later.
So... my plan right now is basically to go through the TLS notes solutions code,
exam notes code. But it's really code that we've been going through in various forms, most of the terms. So rather than that, I prefer for you all to give me questions on things that you are wondering about. I'm assuming that I can try imparting wisdom and saying this will be, but fundamentally I've been trying to do that for months now. So a little direction would be helpful. Yes.
Yep. Or potentially with a couple of, I'm still finalizing, but there's a couple of questions that are a little more general. But most of the questions are very focused on the code. If there is, there's a few of them that you have to things like, how would you add a button, kind of thing. I mean, if it's implementation, it's a couple of lines. And it's a couple of lines that you should be able to crib close pieces of from elsewhere in the source code.
So when we answer those questions, can we just write out the code, or do you want to explain them?
So for example, you're talking about the last question on the midterm. So the last question on the midterm, if you had given me a proper implementation, I would have given you full credit. But in general, writing a full implementation, I was much more lenient if you gave me an explanation, because there's a few minor details you can leave out in a written description that doesn't work so well if you're looking at it. So yes, you're going to have to explain, you're going to have to say, okay, how do I write this? So I don't call that an implementation question. I call that more of a design question. So yes, the midterm, that's right there. But again, I don't like having to look at your lines of code individually and trying to grade them, because little problems can cause great things. You should be able to describe the code in the high level and basically what you're doing. As you saw, if you look at the solutions for the midterm, my answers aren't that long. Apply. It won't be on the midterm, but Actually, I take that back. Call is on the...
Wow. Still waiting to log in. Wow. Impressive. Okay,
So talking about apply, so you have... So this is saying, it's good to review the ways that you can call a function. Because again, whenever you see open and closed parentheses beside a symbol in JavaScript, you're calling a function in some form. So the contexts are... So there's the function context, method, function, method, apply, I'm missing one, what? Oh, thank you. And the thing to understand between these is just what, the only difference between these is the value of this. That's the only difference. So, what's the value of this here? So, this is the object. So, this is the one where this makes the most sense because you're dealing with a method, and so you want to refer to the object for which this is a method. This is that. This is the object that you're using. But in this case, this doesn't make sense because you're calling a function in the context of what object? There isn't one. So what it should be is this should be undefined when you call it without, when it's not a method of an object. But instead, it's global object. So, bad. That's just messed up. It shouldn't be that way. Now, when you apply, you specify. This allows you to essentially use, let's say you have a method, and you want to apply that method to an object, but you don't want to manually assign it. Like, you just want to do a one-off applying the method to that object. So instead of assigning it as a method, you just use apply. Or you use apply and call. And then, constructor, you get an empty object. This is an empty object because you're making a new object, so you get an empty object. Again, for the stuff that we're covering here in the code that we're using, you don't have to think about this so much because we didn't really go through a lot of the object stuff. I mean, it's there underneath the surface, but that hasn't been my emphasis. If you do more advanced JavaScript programming, you definitely want to learn this more. My focus has been more on the web side of things as opposed to just language features. I wanted you to learn enough JavaScript so you could understand the code I was giving you, but you are not a JavaScript master. Okay, I have something here, but okay, connecting to the printer, exactly what I wanted to do. Okay, something's happening there. I'll just let that keep logging in. But come on, give me some... What I can start talking about, guys, what do you think of the email that went out from Abe? Was that helpful?
Yes.
So that concerns me a little bit, if that...
I'm glad that was helpful.
But he was talking about some very basic things. Because so this is all around assignment 9. And so what I was trying to get at is that when you're talking about a web application, you have the server, you have the client, aka the web browser. So in the case of our application, we have Node here. We have JavaScript and page. So what happens is the browser, you're always running JavaScript in the context of a page. What is a page? A page is an HTML document. HTML and CSS, those get read into the browser, they get turned into a data structure that JavaScript can access. That is the document object model. And so when you use jQuery in JavaScript, what you're doing is accessing that HTML and CSS, allowing you to change it because it's just basically a big data structure that's then used by the browser to render the interface. Have a page, and then you have the node, the server. And so we're running JavaScript here. What connects these two? How do they talk to each other? What? The router? No, that's not how they talk to, the router is on one side of this, but that's not how they're talking to each other. Yes? The browser makes requests to the server. The server responds. It has a router decide how to respond. But what's this space? HTTP. The connection here is HTTP. Potentially encrypted, but that's what's going back and forth. So when I say HTTP is going back and forth, I'm saying specifically the client is sending a GET. And then this sends a response. And then this sends a POST. And you have a response. It's just an error. I'll push this up. That's what you have that's what's happening. That's what we're seeing. That's what you saw in assignment 9 was the HTTP traffic going back and forth between these two pieces. Now, that what's underneath HTTP, that's what you learn in 3203, the networking class. That's where you learn, there's TCP/IP, there's Ethernet, there's the stack of stuff that allows you to do this sort of communication over the internet. That's outside the scope of this class. But what you should know is that you send bytes one way and bytes come back. It's a stream of characters. Well, a stream of bytes going back and forth, because you don't just have to send text, you send binary information such as images. The HTTP protocol says, how do you understand those bytes going back and forth? Instead of this being HTTP, it could be something like SMTP. If it's SMTP, that's email. That's how you send email back and forth. It's your protocol. But instead here, we're talking HTTP. That is a protocol that is used for web servers and web browsers to communicate with each other. Now, the important thing is, can the server just decide to talk to the web browser? No! It cannot directly talk. The only time it can talk is in reply to a request. If the browser has done a GET, it's possible to leave the connection open and the server basically say, well, I'm not going to reply to that just yet. And then there's things like WebSockets, we're going to open another network connection or whatever, that's separate. But fundamentally, the server is waiting.
4 requests. And the browser is initiating them. So then, if you're looking at the browser initiating these requests, how are they being initiated? Why is the browser making these requests? Well, the first request is because the user decided to visit the page. The user clicked on a link, selected a bookmark, typed it into the URL bar, a URL got put into the web browser. The URL had a hostname and then some other stuff to get to the web server. The browser took the hostname, established a network connection, talked to the server, and sent that initial GET request over. Once that GET request goes over to the server, then the server now will send some information back to the browser. Now the thing is, the stuff that's sent back is HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. The HTML can contain links, A tags. The A tags, if the user clicks on them, will generate another HTTP GET. They can contain script tags. A script tag means grab a JavaScript page, I think, from a server. That will cause an HTTP GET request. They may contain image tags. That means you do an HTTP GET for an image. So in order to load the page, once you get that first page, that can cause a whole bunch of GET requests. And then if you decide to submit a form, you type in a username and password that does a post to the server, that you had a form on the page, that then caused a post to go to the server. Yes, there's a question? I thought I saw a hand up. So that's the basic flow of information. That's what we're doing. We've been doing throughout this class. So when you're trying to understand the code of what we've been writing, it's all in this context. So now I see. Oh, okay. I have something here. Sort of. Wow. This looks sad. I think this is fate telling me I'm supposed to just use a chalkboard.
Which is okay. Don't think I'm moving that chalkboard. No, there. There we go. So what's the structure of the things that we have on these different sides? So you have on the server side, you have we have this node program. Right? What is node.js? You type this, in general you've been typing bin/www, right? Bin/www is a JavaScript program running in the node interpreter. You also have run this program by saying node and something.js. Same thing. All the cases that this is basically a JavaScript. It's a JVM, but it's a JavaScript virtual machine, not a Java virtual machine. It's an execution environment for running JavaScript. It takes in JavaScript code and runs it in an environment. There's a big difference between this JavaScript virtual machine. There's also a JavaScript virtual machine running inside the context of this page. What's the difference between these two, other than the fact that they're running on the server and the client? There's a fundamental difference between the capabilities of these two things. What's the difference?
I/O file system. Basically, what's the term for that? It's sandboxed. That's the fundamental thing to understand, is that the JavaScript there is sandboxed, meaning that it is in its own little world. It can't go and talk to the rest of the internet willy-nilly. It can't access the computer. It's separated. This is not sandboxed. Thus, the JavaScript running on the server has full access to the system. You notice that we could, on node.js, we could do things like access command line variables. We could change environment variables. You know, we saw we were doing all these things with opening network connections, and we were talking to databases and stuff. I mean, fundamentally, anything you could do, I mean, almost, look, you can do essentially anything in a Java virtual, in this JavaScript virtual machine, that you could do with a regular C program, except just sort of access uninitialized memory. You can't do things with random pointers. But why do you want to? You're doing these data structure stuff. When you want to do anything with accessing the outside world, you have to make system calls. JavaScript can make the Node.js context can make system calls just as much as any C program. It can thus do anything in terms of talking to the outside world. It can do I/O. It can do, you know, there's a network. In principle, you could write graphical applications in a Node.js thing with the right libraries and stuff. It's just, you just don't normally do that. It's not the best fit for things, especially because one thing Node.js doesn't by default really do is have threads, although there are things called web workers and things, ways to do threading, but that's not fundamental to the JavaScript memory. So, why do I bring this up? Because the point of thinking of things as web applications as opposed to classic web, just web servers and stuff, is like with a web server, you have that server running some code. Well, let's try to do this. You know why she moved that to that? You want to start with an old style server. So this is an old style server. You have a the web server, you have the web browser. This has files. You have HTML files that were sent to the browser. The web browser does a GET. The web server sends back files. HTML or JPEG. And you're talking about mosaic time of web servers. What were the web servers doing? They just took this GET request, looked at that path. You know, that path looks kind of like a file path, does it? Directories, and that's what it was. It was a file path, and there'll be a directory where all the web service files are. This is still the way a lot of web servers are. In that directory, there's all these web files, and it just looks for that directory and then serves up that file. We can do that in this world.
couple of statements in app.js and add a static web server to Node. And what does that static web server do? It serves files. Where are those files located? In the public directory. Everything in the public directory is just sent to the web browser as requested. So any file name, any path in there will be parsed and say, okay, that's where I'm supposed to return. But what about for things that don't match files? This is the main part of why you bother with something like Node. It's not for serving files, and there's lots of other programs for doing that. Apache, Nginx, whatever. They'll take care of the file part. You use something like Node because you want to run code. That means that instead of sending back files, you want to run some code. That's what it's really about. You run code to produce HTML. And then that gets sent back. Now what's JavaScript in the browser doing in this picture? Why run code? You look at JavaScript in the browser, in the server, the JavaScript is there fundamentally to determine how do I send HTML back to the client? How do I respond to a GET request? GET request comes in, I need to send something back. I need to send some data. I'm going to programmatically generate that. Normally what you programmatically generate is HTML, but in principle you could dynamically generate anything. You dynamically generate images. Dynamically generate video if you're fast enough. Generally, you want to do that asynchronously. Video takes a lot of computation, but that's the only reason why. JavaScript in the browser is doing two things. Really? Well, user interface, but what does that mean? What's nitty gritty? What is it doing? Manipulating DOM. So, you notice I said over here you run code to produce HTML. Over here, DOM manipulation means run code to change HTML. That's what it is. You have some HTML. HTML and some CSS, and you want to change it. And you want to change it because you want to change what the user sees. You want to change what font there is, you want to change what title there is, you want to move a box around, you want to do whatever. You want to change what they see. So you have code running in the browser to change what they see. That's DOM manipulation. That's what you use the jQuery stuff we showed, was to manipulate the DOM, to change that interface. What else?
Sorry, what was that?
More interactive, but again, when we talk about interactive,
well, I guess you could say DOM manipulation in response to user interaction, in response to network behavior, or whatever, because of the various reasons why you might want to change how the DOM looks. But the DOM, the JavaScript taking in some sort of input and then manipulating the DOM. That's a good point. Input. But that's kind of a silly thing. Yes, of course it's taking input. But the other big thing is it's doing HTTP gets and posts. Now again, we have this HTML. In HTML, we can include various tags that will cause the browser to initiate a get or a post. You want to make the browser initiate a post, you stick in a form. You want to make the browser initiate a get, it depends on what kind of thing you want to get. If you want to get a piece of JavaScript, you put a script tag. You want to have it get an image, you put an image tag. You want it to get another page, HTML. You have to do you just do an A tag, and you have a link, and you click on it, and you load a new page. These are all ways to make a browser initiate gets and posts. But when we have JavaScript running in the browser, in this whole AJAX mode, the JavaScript can do gets and posts for whatever reason it wants. It doesn't have to go through making some HTML tags in order to do stuff. It just directly does it. You do a get JSON, and you ask for JSON data from the server, and it gives you JSON. You do a post, and you just do a post to the server and get back the results. Completely separate from any interaction in HTML land. And why do we do this in the background? We do this in the background so that we can asynchronously update the interface. I mean, before, you in principle can do everything. We're talking about DOM manipulation, taking pages in your request. The server can do all this without having client-side JavaScript. All it has to do is rewrite the page. It just has to make a new page every time. But the problem is, for each one of those, you have to go to the server and get a new page, and then come back. And that does not make for a very fluid interface. So we stick it in the browser, and it does the sort of thing. But it all boiled down to a few of these basic operations. It's all about this HTML thing, either generating on the server, like doing things like Jade, or generating in the browser, or modifying in the browser by using client-side JavaScript. So that's why it's important to understand that wire view, because then you're seeing these two pieces talk to each other. I don't have my picture anymore, so. I might have a web browser now. Ooh, exciting. Will it run? Maybe. Oh, that didn't go so well. What was that? I can't close that. This is so sad. Anyway. So, oh yay! I can now show you something. Okay, let's go here. So, let's make this a little bigger. So, you'll notice here, exam notes. If you want to download it, download it. Please do. Download it and run it. See what it does. But you should be able to figure out what it does from the code, because it's darn similar to code that you've already seen. So what do we have here? We have this routes index.js. First off, what's the relationship of this file to the other files in Express? So let me just go ahead and download this here. I'm not going to run it, but at least we can look around it. Like I'm pushing around an old man, making it trying to do stuff. Come on, do tricks. So let's look at the files here. We have routes index.js. We have public JavaScript register.js. We have public JavaScript note.js. Views layout.jade, views index.jade, views notes.jade, views error.jade. So these are not all the files there, but these are the key ones I wanted you to focus on. So in particular, which of these files are executed? So all of these start on the server. Which of these files are interpreted or run on the server? Index.js, yes. This file is definitely run on the server. What else is run on the server here? Are these run on the server? No. These files, notice the public part. Everything in public is going to be served as a file to the browser when it's requested. It's not going to be interpreted, or nothing's going to happen to it on the server. It's just going to be sent to browser. Someone's dinging a lot. Anyway. I know it's not me. So anything in public is going to just be interpreted as a file and sent to the browser. So public JavaScript register.js, public JavaScript notes.js, that's not being run on the server. That's just being sent byte for byte to the browser. Now, what about these JADE files? What's happening with them? So they're run on the server, yes. JADE files are run on the server, but what happens to them on the server? The way that when you run a JADE file, it outputs HTML. Now, code is running on the server side because potentially, remember, we had, you know, like all this stuff here. Well, we have here a conditional. This conditional is evaluated on the server. Remember earlier in the term, we saw the for loops in JADE files that ran on the server. But then they generate an HTML file, and where did that file go? It went to the browser. And the browser interpreted that HTML. And that HTML could cause it to do things. Like, for example, index.js, what does it have in here? It says, okay, this will all get turned into HTML, but part of the things it will do is it will have this script tag. That script tag tells the browser that when it loads this page, to go ask, hey, load this JavaScript file from the server. JavaScript register.js. So sure enough, in the public directory, you look over here, we have this public JavaScript register.js. So the browser is going to do this GET request for this file, and then it will return. And when it returns this file, it will evaluate it. It will run it. And so when this code happens, what will happen when this runs? Let's walk through this. This is a nice short piece of JavaScript. What's it do? So first off, at a literal level, what are we doing? Let's start at the very beginning. What's that? $ open paren, that means we're calling jQuery. another name for the jQuery method, top level object is dollar. Now, notice one thing, when you do a lot of browser client side JavaScript, you tend to want to make as few names in the, you don't want to pollute the namespace in the browser. So you don't just sit there and create like 50 different objects. What you always do is normally, when you load a given file, it should just create one object. And anything else you have is just off of that one object. So everything related to jQuery is named jQuery.something. Or it's in the jQuery object itself. And here, for ease of use, dollar sign has been assigned to the jQuery thing. You could choose to make dollar sign equal to whatever you want, but that's just the convention here. Because you use it all the time, it makes the code a lot easier to read. So at a bare level, all that's happening is we are calling jQuery, and we are calling it with what? We're giving it one argument. The one argument we're giving it is a function, an anonymous function. We have not given it a name. But we have defined this function right here, and we set it, and then we said, here you go, here's your function, pass that as an argument. Did we run this function? No. We have not gotten anything. We have not run this function. Who calls this function? This is all running in the browser. We're running the browser. That's like saying, who calls Node? Who runs the function Node? Node runs it. The server runs it. I mean, it's true, but not specific. So yes, we called jQuery. We gave jQuery the function. So who's going to call the function? Well, where the point is, who can access the function? Who can even see this function? Like, if I write some code here, just right after the semicolon, if I put some more code here, can it access this function? No. It has no way of even referring to it. It can't even talk about it because it doesn't have a name for it. It was defined inside this parentheses, and now I can't say anything about it. The only name this function was ever given was as an argument to jQuery. The jQuery function said, I have an argument. It's called foo. I don't know what it's called. It's got some name. jQuery got it. No one else has it. So if anyone's going to call it, jQuery's going to call it. If jQuery doesn't call it, it won't get called ever. So we gave a function to jQuery and said, run it, please. When does jQuery normally run these functions? When? No. That is not when the user clicks register. We'll get to that in a second. Yes? When the page has finished loading. Because remember, when you have these, you look at these files, you look at this stuff, you go, we got this. What if I just started running the Bootstrap code and jQuery hadn't loaded? Because remember, these could be going to different servers. You could be waiting for different things. Everything, it's all asynchronous. You don't know when everything is loaded. And if you want your JavaScript to only load, to run, after everything's there, you need some way of seeing it. There's standard ways of doing it we haven't talked about, but the jQuery way of doing it, here's a function. Run this when the page is finished loading. Because otherwise, you might get a page that is only partially there. You can actually get things where the top of the page is there and the bottom of the page isn't. And then when you try accessing the part of the DOM for that thing that's at the bottom of the page, it won't even be there. But browsers render pages as they get loaded because people don't want to wait. They want to see what they can. And you've seen pages, things move around and stuff while the page is loading. That's as these different files come in, as the browser interprets them and says, I'm supposed to apply this style sheet. Why was I using that font? What a fool. I should change to this. Updates as it goes. So this is saying, I don't want to mess with this whole some of the page is loaded and some of the page hasn't loaded. I just run it after you've loaded everything, after all the GET requests have finished. So that's what this is. So jQuery will run this function once the page is fully loaded. How many times will it run this function? Once. It will run it once. Once per page load. And then what does this do? Now this code again calls jQuery. When does this, what does this code do? It says, oh, here's, we're calling jQuery. What are we giving to jQuery? A string. What happens when we give jQuery the string? What's it going to return to us? Just from the syntax here, I can tell you what type it's going to return to me. Because the thing I have following it is a dot. So whatever it returns must be an object. Because whatever that object is, I'm going to access a method of it. And I'm assuming that the method on exists. And that's a pretty safe bet because essentially on is defined on most DOM elements. So as long as this maps something in the DOM, you're fine. So what is this saying? This is saying, return to me the part of the DOM that has the ID of register. So this assumes that there is something in the DOM that has an ID of register. So this, where was this JavaScript loaded? What context was loaded? The context of index.js. So is there something here called register? Yes, right here. The very bottom, there's an ID of register. And that ID of register is associated with the button, the register button. Notice this is register button, warning type button. See, if you have a button that is of type submit, it means that it's for submitting a form. If it's of type button, it means it's a button. You just press it. It presses, thing pops back. That's it. Press it, pop back. It does nothing when you declare it as type button. You have to implement the functionality elsewhere for the button to do anything. This submit button, this does something. This causes a post request, uses the action, you know, it uses the action, uses this method, it does, you know, it makes this form go. But this button by itself does nothing. Except for doing a little animation there, that clicking thing. So, but that's why we have this code here, because this says on click. So this is a method saying now, we're gonna call this method of this DOM object, which was that button, and we're saying when that button on click event, so click is a type of event, we're passing it as a string, but on a click event, what's this? Another function defined out honestly, in line. We're giving the DOM a function. Basically, we're telling the browser, saying, we are manipulating the DOM, we're registering a function to be called when the button is pressed. It's an event handler. The event is the click event on the register button. So why is the click event on the register button? Because we got the register button here, and we said on click. So when the click event happens, when the user clicks on that button, or taps it with their finger on a touch screen or whatever, it still generates a click event, call this function. So this code here is loaded, is executed when the file is loaded. So the entire, everything in the enclosing dollar sign. The inner function here is loaded when the function is loaded when the page finishes loading. This is then executed. So when this function is called, this is executed, which defines an onClick handler. When is this handler function executed? When someone clicks the button. So what if no one ever clicks the button? It doesn't get run. It never runs. What if someone clicks the button 50 times? It gets run 50 times. So, now of course, what does this actually do? When you click this button, it causes a, it does this little bit of fun stuff. What is this thing doing? So first off here, it's saying, oh, var form, so this dollar here is just the name form. We didn't need a dollar here. This is just being used as a name. This is jQuery, this little dollar by itself. So it's saying jQuery, give me the part of the DOM that's a form. Now, if I had 10 forms in the page, this would return me all 10 forms. But I only have one form in the page, so I'm just getting that form. I probably could have named the form to do something, but here I just give me the form. There's only one form. Just give it to me. So I've got this form now, and now I do this thing of I change an attribute of it. I change the attribute of the action part to be register. What was the action part for the register? Because there was a form here. If you look here, there was a form here. Here's the form. It had an action of login. So we just changed, what did we change that action to? We changed it here to register. We dynamically change it to register, and then we call submit. So when we say submit, it means submit the form. Pretend a submit button has been pressed. Do that submission. Generate that post. Go do it. So we manipulate the form, make it now a... But we're just making the action, so we're saying don't go to login because we're not logging in. We're registering. So go to register and then submit the form. Now, what should be familiar to you is, yes, this is client-side JavaScript. Yes, there is this form stuff. Yes, there's this thing. But the basic pattern, the basic structure of the JavaScript should be familiar by now. What are we always doing? We call functions as methods. When we call a method, we give it as an argument, things like strings, and we give them functions. When we give them functions, which are potentially defined inline or defined elsewhere, that function is going to be run at some other point. And when that function will be run depends upon the context, depends on who we gave it to. When you give it to one person, they'll call it a bunch of times. Someone else, they may never call it at all. It just depends on what who you gave it to. Well, I could have made this http://google.com/register.
But you would be here, right? When you want to, instead of logging in for registration, you can get a bunch of people from wherever they do it.
You're saying, should I have sent them to a page for registering?
Yeah,
I could have. I could have done it from here. I could have instead. I would keep the page exactly the same. When you click the register button instead of submitting the form, what would I instead put there? So I haven't shown you programmatically, but you basically there's a simple thing of there's a little thing of jQuery that you say you give it a link and say go to that link. And so under JavaScript control, you just give that link and you just call it. So yeah, you could have just visited a new page under the control of JavaScript. That's perfectly doable. So there's so much you can do with web programming. I can't show you all the possibilities. What I can try to show you is the patterns. So why am I emphasizing this call thing? Because what about, well here again, what are we doing here with the what's this right here? It's another click handler. Here, it's the edit button for whatever ith note. I say, what do? You call edit note, but you give it this argument, user note sub I. It turns out this is the event data. I'm generating manually a click event, and I'm calling event note. And so, I mean, edit note. And so edit note is over here. See, edit note takes this event. And so event.data is there. So that's how I get the note back out. And then I do all the stuff to it. And here I, add in a click event. I change the value. But again, notice I keep passing in these callback functions. It's all over the place. It's a basic pattern. If you don't feel comfortable about this, then work on it. Try to look at it. Try to understand what's going on with these callbacks. Because remember, when I specified the function here, this function is not being called here. I'm giving the function to this other routine to call at some later time. So let's look at the server. So this is in index.js. So when you say, get notes, write it at get notes, what is this actually? Literally, what is this saying? Again, this is saying we have an object called router. Router has a method called get. We're calling the get method with two arguments. One argument is a string. Another argument is a function that happens to take two arguments, request and response. When does this method get invoked? When does this get invoked? When is this run? No. No. That's a very big no. Yes? When I start the server. When I start the server is when this is called. It is only run once. There's nothing magic to the semantics here. I mean, when you have a function call and it's in there, is it going to be like, you want some code to be run arbitrary numbers of times whenever a get request comes in. Can you run that when the file's being loaded? No. Do we have a loop here waiting for a request coming in? No. Is there a loop waiting for a request? Yes. But it's not defined in our code. That's what that whole HTTP server thing is. Go back and if you want to see a little more of the structure of things of how you do this, it's go back to assignment 3 and you see that, the simple web server. That gives you a more kind of structure of what it is. But still, the event loop is not defined by us. The event loop is already there. We're sticking things into the event loop. That's all this router get is saying, add something into the event handler. We're basically saying, you're going to have an event. The event is, you're going to get an incoming HTTP get request for /get notes. When that event happens, run this code. So this function, none of this code is run. None of the body of this thing here, none of this code here is run when the server is first loaded. And in fact, in principle, this code might never run. It would only run if somehow there is a get notes. I mean, I could define additional routes. Like I could define /backdoor. What would /backdoor do when you go to /backdoor? It just gives you all the notes. For everyone. Classic kind of backdoor. Give you all the data. Do I have any link in the rest of the program to the backdoor? No. Would this code ever be run normally? No. But if someone typed into their browser, go to localhost /backdoor, and then all of a sudden they get all the data. That's the thing about these routes. These routes are not run until there's a reason. They only run when the event happens. But this is an event handler just the same as back with a register. This register, we're defining an event handler. But this event handler we're defining is on the click event. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about two different things. I'm talking about two very different things. I'm saying that this right here is executed only once. This is executed only once, but when it's executed, what I'm saying is this is a definition of a function. Do you see this function being called here? No, it's not being called. There is no open closed parens for this function. I mean, if I wanted to call it right now, I could put an open and closed paren right there at the end of the function definition, and it would call the function. But I'm not calling it. I'm just defining it. If you just define a function and you don't call it, it doesn't run. So when you pass a function as an argument, then it's not being run. It's only being run if you call it, if you have the open and closed parens and you give arguments, zero or more. This is not being called. That's what this here is just being given as. See, this is the whole thing about functions as first-class, as a first-class data type. It means functions act as code and as data. So here, initially, when you run this code, this function is data. It's just being passed on. But then later, it will be run, and then it will be code. In most languages, when you define functions, the only time it's never really think of it as data because you don't pass it around. It's just, here's a function, here's a function, here's a function. In a language like JavaScript, you define functions on the fly and then pass them around as arguments. You can do this in other languages, but it's not the style. And the language doesn't have as much support for it. I mean, JavaScript, that's what you do. And the reason you do it so much is because JavaScript is designed to be event-based. And if you've got an event, what do you do in response to the event? Honestly, I don't. Other languages, you have event handlers. You might have to say, well, here's the event handler. You register it, and it does this. And you can kind of do various ways. But the most natural way I can think of for doing event handling is, here's an event. Here's a function that you call when the event happens. Because you want to run code when the event happens. You just have to specify which code. That's why you give it. So I've just given this as data saying, whenever you get a call for get notes, if ever it happens, run this code. So that's what it means to be an event handler. Is you define that the handler is for the event and only runs when the event happens, and it runs as many times as the event happens. So this is an event handler for an HTTP GET request event going into the node server. The register here, we've got a click handler. This is an event handler for a click event, which happens in the browser, happens in the page when a button is clicked on. Whenever you see a callback, a function being defined as data, being passed on, you should think that it is being used for some sort of event that's going to happen. And something, when I say an event, I mean something that's going to happen at some future time. It's not defined exactly when that will happen. Maybe we have some ideas when it will happen, but we can't say it precisely. That's why we're passing it along. So for example here, MC Connect. We're connecting to the database. So I've simplified this code here, by the way. Before, I had this in a function that was then called immediately. Here, I'm not having a function that called. I just put it immediately in here, MC Connect. I got rid of the callback stuff. But what I did was MC Connect to MongoLook exam notes. Notice I changed the collection. So this is exam notes. And then, oh, I've got this function here. I'm calling MC Connect, I'm giving it a string, and I'm giving it a function. When is this function going to be run? I don't know specifically, but it's going to be called once it's done connecting to the database. That's when it will be called. When it's done connecting to the database, it will call this. At least when it tried connecting to the database. And then here it's going to go, did we connect to the database successfully or not? If there's an error object, we failed. We didn't connect to the database. Something's wrong. This happens to a lot of my machines, and a lot of times I leave MongoDB not running. So I'll start up it up, and then it says, oh, can't run. And so it throws this exception here. If I had a catch statement here, I could have caught it, but I don't have a catch statement, so we depend upon the framework's catch statement, which crashes and leaves all this big, you know, error thing saying, oh, look, we couldn't connect, and the server goes down. But if there wasn't an error, we connected successfully. So we assign this, and that's it. We're done. We've done this assignment. We defined the variables here. We've assigned them here. Now they can be used here. So what you should see here is that is there a time period in which it is possible for one of these routers to be called? So like right here, we're doing this users collection update. What happens if this call happens before this code is executed? What will happen to the server? This value is undefined. You can't access a property of undefined because undefined is not an object. So it'll crash with this big error, a runtime error saying you can't do that. So if I wanted to be really careful here, I could put a check. Well, if users collection, then do this. Why don't I have that check in there? Because you'll never? That's not true. I mean, what can happen is, let's say your database is taking a really long time to connect. Like you're kind of waiting for the network connection, there's some problems, so it's trying to connect, hasn't succeeded, but hasn't failed, but you have an incoming request for, say, you know, register. It could happen that you get here, and the database, you haven't succeeded or failed, and you get here, and it just goes. So, but if, well, I mean, this is, again, class code. I haven't made it fully bulletproof, but that's, what would happen then is, I mean, why did I bother? I'll bother with it because I've got this here. I'm assuming this is probably going to succeed or fail pretty quickly. If this succeeds or fails pretty quickly, we're either going to get the collection up or we're just going to crash the server. So the window of exposure of either things being working or being broken is very small. But it exists. But again, if you're not connected to the database, what's the user going to see? They're just going to see a broken web app. But I'm just pointing out, it's perfectly possible for, there's nothing in this code that prevents that this being called before it's been defined. I mean, I've put this here so it's at least has a value. It's undefined, it's declared. But yeah, that's going to fail if that MC Connect has not run. And I cannot guarantee exactly when it will run. So proper code, proper thing would do some sort of check here. But it would also make the code really ugly. Because you'd have if statements for every access to it. So if I wanted to do something careful, I can maybe make my own users collection that wraps this and that checks to see if it's there. So I have all my checks centralized in one place and then pass it on. But do you all see that error state? If you see that error state, you're seeing the asynchronous nature of this. If you don't see it, you should ask questions. I apologize, though, you feel like this is easy. I already got it. It's all simple, but.
Okay, I'm getting confused, but the check username is only going to be a call.
Actually, this one's not going to error out. This one's going to error out. Very true.
Okay.
Hmm?
Is my
Yeah, you're right. This is the one that's going to get called first. Because this, in fact, is a callback. And it's going to call check username. And that's, in fact, here, all that you have here is you define this variable, define this variable, we define this function, we define this function, and then we run this. There's only one statement that's actually run in this entire function. After that, it's just giving callbacks. I get called after callbacks. I get called after callbacks. This one gets run first with a find user. It gets past this. When this function will be run, I don't know. But if user's collection is not defined, we're going to blow up big time here. So if you could say, I'll just put a test here for the first use of user's collection. I don't have to bother with this. Because if it works here, it's defined elsewhere. We're going to assume that it doesn't go to undefined after being defined. Which can happen in the sense of you could lose your connection to your database. This is why proper industrial strength code is big and messy, because most of the code is error checking for all kinds of weird things that can happen, like these. Another thing I changed is you might notice that there is no calls to bcrypt in this code. Bcrypt has been excised. And instead, what does we do? We do a find one, we call it the user collection, we do the check username. In the check username, we say, oh, you know, if you get here, if there's an error, if there's an error, we couldn't, you know, the database, we couldn't get the thing from the database. Otherwise, we check, is the user null? That means, okay, if the user is null, then that means we actually, the user doesn't already exist, because this is the register. So we create an object for that new user, and then we do an update, we do upsert, so we'll insert it properly. And then we set the username's here. But notice right here, what did I do right here? I did not hash it. I just put the password in the database, in plain text. Look at how much simpler the code is. It's a lot easier to understand. It's really simple, huh? Don't do it! Don't do it! And in fact, I guarantee you, I will ask you an exam question which says why this is a bad idea. Freebie. So, why is this a bad idea? Database ever gets hacked, now given some particular attacker every user's password. That's not nice. Especially since people tend to use passwords across multiple sites. Not nice. If you had it properly hashed, I'm not saying it's impossible for them to get the passwords out of it, it's just a lot of work. That's the beautiful thing about bcrypt. Even if your password database gets compromised, you're not completely screwed. But this, you're in bad shape. So, and that also means that, like, if anyone kind of is snooping around and gets their password, and you could, like, any of your insiders, any of your employees in your company can now find out people's passwords. Nobody should have access to people's passwords. It's too dangerous. So. And then you'll notice that since I did it this way, then when I go to login is just this now. There's no hashing. Does it find one, pulls it out, checks it, and just checks to see, was there an error, or was the user null, or was the password not equal? One line of checks. Else, that. What do I mean by hashing? What I mean is turning it into the obfuscated mess that bcrypt does. No. The difference between encrypting and hashing is that hashing loses information. With encryption, all the data is in principle there. You can get it back out. With a hash, you've lost information. In principle, you can get it back out. You can't ever be sure that that was exactly what you got out. Now, there's various entropy arguments and stuff, and you can say, well, I don't actually think this was what was hashed or something, but. Like, for example, hashes are always fixed size, while encrypted data has to be variable size. Well, let's say you have a 1 gig file. If I want to encrypt it, it's going to be about a gig. You know, if I can compress it, maybe it'll be half a gig. Or something like that. But if I hash a gig file, how big is the hash? However large the hash size is. You know, 128 is a bit small. Nowadays, you know, 160 or preferably 256 or 512 bits. That's a hash. From a gig file. And why is the hash useful? Because, like, where do you should use this? You go to a website, like, you go want to buy, download a Linux ISO. Big file. You download it, you go like, did I get the right file or not?
I showed you this, in fact, actually in the... I showed you this in the course outline, I think. Course software, running the VM on your own machine. So, what's this? A hash of a SHA-1 hash. Now, I would have preferred to use a SHA-256 or 512 or whatever, but SHA-1 is more widely supported, and it's good enough for this purpose. So I've got this big file here. It's about a gig. If you download this file and something messes up, well, how do you... Well, you download this file. And you then tell me, I tried using the file, but it didn't import into my virtual machine. It didn't import into VirtualBox. And I'll ask me, did you check the file? It's like, okay, if you checked the file, it means you computed the hash of the file, and did you get this number? If you didn't get this number, your file is corrupted. Can I be perfectly sure that your file wasn't corrupted, that in fact it was... No. If this is different, your file is different. It's possible that your file is the same, that your file was corrupted and your hash is the same, but the probability is smaller than like 1 in the number of atoms in the universe, kind of small. It's a really small number. It's not happening. Your file is corrupt, your file is fine if this hash is fine. Okay, so I'm just about out of time here. So again, basically what's the structure of the midterm? More questions, more code, but same basic format. I mean, look at the assignments. I draw from the assignments. I try, bring those in. Remember, these assignments have all been on different aspects of this. Should I, what can I ask you for? It's like, what if I showed you some HTTP requests? And I say, what sort of response would you expect to get from this? What part of the code would generate this? I'm not going to be asking questions about the SSL part. That's why I specifically did include those files. Not to say I wouldn't love to grill you about that, but that's stuff I want you to learn, but it's stuff I'm not going to test you on. Because that's not the core material. That's why I did like the bonus mark if you're generating your own certificate. So. But this is... I specifically said I'm not going to include other files from here. So any sort of functionality you need for be basically in here. Other questions? Okay. Good luck. See you Tuesday.